WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
It was 1971 when Michael Doris was 26, single, and a self-described ex-would-be hippie that he decided he wanted to be a parent. He became one of the first unmarried men to legally adopt a very young child. Adam was 3 years old and diagnosed as mentally retarded when Doris adopted him, but Doris later discovered his son really had fetal alcohol syndrome. FAS is a combination of mental disabilities and physical deformities that result from the mother drinking during pregnancy. Doris is a novelist and an adjunct professor of anthropology and Native American studies at Dartmouth College. He's part Modoc Indian, and his son Adam is Sioux. Doris has found that fetal alcohol syndrome is one of the gravest dangers facing Native Americans today. It's the subject of his new book, The Broken Cord. Michael Doris is now married to the writer Louise Erdrich, whose novels include Love Medicine and The Beet Queen. They have 6 children, 3 that he adopted before their marriage in 1981, and 3 they had together. Doris told me why he wanted to adopt the child when he was still single.
I come from a long line of single parents who happened to be women, but my mother and her mother and her mother all had been widowed early and had raised children, I hope successfully, without being a double parent family. So that was my role model. It wasn't that I self-consciously planned to be a single parent, but rather that I got to a point in my life where I really wanted children. And the way to get children, if I wasn't married and I was a male, was to adopt.
What kinds of questioning did you have to undergo before you were allowed to adopt? Were there certain suspicions against you because you were a single man?
Well, I think it was looked upon as a real strange thing, because I went through this process in Alaska, where I was living at the time, and the only agency that even answered my letter of inquiry was Catholic Charities. And I had my initial interview with a nun there, and she broached the subject, was I doing this by any chance because I was an anthropologist? And that question really threw me for a loop, as if I had intended to raise a child as a kind of experiment. And so I said, no, you know, I'm doing it because I want to be a father. Then a social worker came out, and there was a period of kind of feeling each other out as me trying to figure out what questions she was asking and what was the hidden agenda, and I think her trying to figure out why I was making this petition. But after a period of time, we simply became friends and talked about being parents, and she was anticipating parenthood too, so it became very natural.
Were you specifically looking for a Native American baby?
I felt that as an Indian person myself, I probably could have more to offer for a Native American child. The other aspect was, I think it was probably easier for me to get a placement because some mothers would specify that they would like their child raised in a household where they would have access to their own ethnic heritage and background, and that I could offer.
Mm-hmm. Well, the child who you were offered was Adam, who you adopted. He was 3 at the time, and he was diagnosed as mentally retarded. Did you have any reservations about taking on the responsibilities of a retarded child?
I didn't believe the diagnosis. I was, as you say, in my early 20s. This was just after the 1960s. It was a period of time, I think, when people of my generation were ultimately very optimistic, and also a period of time where to believe anything other than nurture determined the outcome of a child was considered quite bad taste and perhaps even politically wrong. I certainly was in that camp. I believed that nurture was everything. And when I heard that my son was young for his age, which was the euphemism for mildly retarded, I actually looked upon that as a good thing because I figured he would be more my own child being young. It would be almost as if I were adopting him when he was 1.5 or 2 rather than 3.
Mm-hmm. He was also abused before you adopted him, abused by his mother. He had been tied to the bars of the crib. He was half-starved. Did you know all that at the time?
I did. I also knew that his mother had been an alcoholic, and I knew that she had died from alcohol poisoning. But at the time, again, that was not considered pertinent information. If I had had the prescience to go and look in a medical textbook in 1971 and look up alcohol and see if it was a problem, what I would have found in the pharmacological textbook that was used in most medical schools was the warning that the only reason not to drink alcohol during pregnancy was that you might gain weight, but that though it crossed the placental barrier, it did the developing fetus no harm. That was the information in the textbooks at that time, and certainly nobody told me that this was something to be particularly concerned about, and I wasn't.
Well, what led you to finding out about fetal alcohol syndrome was your son's seizures. This wasn't a part of what was expected when your son was diagnosed as mildly retarded. And the seizures led you to a series of doctors who also didn't say anything about fetal alcohol syndrome. You found out about it by through a drug rehabilitation center.
It was almost 11 years after the adoption had been finalized. There had accumulated a series of discrete symptoms, both in terms of my son's physical problems, everything from poor hearing and eyesight and too many teeth in his mouth, curvature of the spine, poor balance, you name it, a whole range of things that had to do with the development of his bone structure and major organs, and then a whole series of behavioral problems as well. The fact that he found it very hard to learn new things. It took me, I would say 2 years to teach him to tie his shoes. It took until he was almost 8 before he was toilet trained. Each of these things I explained to myself as simply catching up, that he had been traumatized, that he was young for his age, and that there would be a breakthrough and everything would fall into place by the time he was 21. He would be able to do all these things. But nevertheless, because he was hyperactive in school, I did see a number of counselors, neurologists, psychologists, etc., all of whom had flashed warning signs, but nobody had a name to put to this collection of symptoms, which seemed unlike anything that was easily labeled. Then in 1981, I was doing some consulting work for the Bush Foundation on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. And I was at a sort of halfway house for teenage kids who had no place else to go. And there was a group came in who reminded me in subtle and yet unmistakable ways of my son and their demeanor and how they interacted with each other and how they watched television and how they stood and so forth. I said to the counselor, "Who are they and what's their story?" And he said to me, "They're FAS. In the world of Indian Affairs, there's a zillion acronyms, and I thought this was just another one, so I asked him what that was, and he said fetal alcohol syndrome, and then described the symptoms of fetal alcohol syndrome, and it was as if he were describing my son, though he had never met him, and it just blew me away.
My guest is Michael Darras, and his new book is called The Broken Cord, and it's a book about his adopted son, Adam, who has fetal alcohol syndrome. How did alcohol become such a problem for Indians? You talk about it a little bit historically in your new book.
Yeah, it's an issue of great debate. There is a stereotype that somehow Indians have, as a group, a lower tolerance for alcohol than non-Indians, and that's pretty much a myth. People who are Asian or Native American sometimes have what they call a flushing effect when they drink. That is, their skin flushes. But that is not going to stop anybody from being an alcoholic, and it doesn't mean that you have a smaller tolerance for alcohol necessarily. Every group has people more or less tolerant of alcohol. It has to do with how your liver processes ethanol. But the way that Indians learned about liquor, I think, has a great deal to do with it. There was no stimulant or depressant drugs among native tribes north of the Rio Grande before contact with Europeans. And like anything else, when it was introduced, people took its method of use from those who introduced it. And in the case of alcohol, it was trappers and traders who were deviant drinkers by European standards, and their practice became associated with Native American use because it always accompanied trade rituals and was, in some respects, incorporated into the drinking behavior. Not necessarily people were drunk, but how you act when you're drinking is different if you're at a fraternity party or if you're with the President of the United States, and a kind of devil-may-care attitude was associated with Indian drinking, though didn't mean that people were drunk, but in sense, in the long run, over generations, it becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy and does cause serious health and social problems.
It was very lucrative, too, for Europeans to sell alcohol to Native Americans. You compare it to today's cocaine rings.
Not only was it lucrative in a direct way, but it was lucrative also because if you're dealing with a trading partner who is drunk, they are much easier to take advantage of.
Mm-hmm. We were talking about drinking among Native Americans. In the introduction to your book, your wife Louise Erdrich explains that she used to be a heavy drinker herself. Did you have drinking problems ever, too, when you were growing up near a reservation?
Well, I think it's the rare Indian person who is not affected by alcohol either directly or indirectly. Certainly, I had a period of my life in which I did drink too much, but I was lucky in that I came from a very sober family, as does Louise, and also it made me sick. And it made me sick enough that it really was a discouragement. After being sick several times, I thought, enough is enough. And so I was fortunate in the sense that my body stopped me, which is what happens actually to a lot of pregnant women in their first trimester. Morning sickness keeps them from drinking. And the problems oftentimes arise in a third trimester situation, which is when the brain is developing at its most accelerated rate.
Well, you're very aware of the fact that alcoholism, the high alcoholism rate among Indians has to do with the victimization of Native Americans. Yet you say, although you know that the pregnant women who drink to excess during pregnancy, who are Native Americans, are victims, that you still can't forgive them for doing it.
Well, I don't mean to be judgmental, but I speak as a parent, and I speak as somebody who sees the effect of somebody's poor choice, bad judgment, ignorance, willful ignorance. I don't know what. I didn't know Adam's mother, but whatever she did has limited his possibilities for the rest of his life. And I don't think that is the kind of choice that one person in morality can make for another.
One of the symptoms of fetal alcohol syndrome is that you don't learn from your mistakes.
Right, yeah.
And you suspect that a lot of the pregnant women who drink are actually victims of fetal alcohol syndrome themselves.
I do think so. It's bad judgment, dealing with abstractions, thinking and conceptualizing things having to do with time, money, relating a consequence to an action, are things that are very, very difficult for fetal alcohol victims to carry forth. Any question why, which requires imagination and anticipation, is going to be problematic for a person with this problem. So if a woman herself is a victim of fetal alcohol syndrome, she's very, very hard to counsel about why she shouldn't drink during pregnancy. And therefore, she may drink during pregnancy, and 9 months or 9 years after the fact, find herself, if in fact she keeps her child, which many FAS mothers don't do, with a child with great problems.
Mm-hmm. One of the most interesting things to me about your new book was watching you wrestle with yourself about what your opinion should be about how to deal with pregnant women who drink. You consider yourself politically very liberal, yet you found yourself having certain opinions that didn't fit in with the other opinions you had. For instance, you were seriously wondering, should women be forced to undergo sterilization if they have had several children who had fetal alcohol syndrome? Should mothers who are alcoholics and refuse to stop drinking be incarcerated during their pregnancy and be forced to not drink? Have you kind of taken a clear stand on where you stand on those issues now?
No, I was not seriously proposing those things, but rather I think this is primarily a woman's issue. And the ideas, those extreme examples that you mentioned, are ideas that have come from women who work on a daily basis with fetal alcohol children and mothers. I heard a story just the other day from one of those women who said that there was a lady that she knew who had had four fetal alcohol children, had abused them and abandoned them. They had been removed from her care. She was pregnant again, and she was drinking. And my friend said to her, "Why are you drinking, and why do you keep getting pregnant?" And this woman, who does not understand the situation because of her own impairment, said, "I love kids, and they keep taking them away from me, and so I keep having them." And this is the extreme case that we're talking about, not a person who can go to a detox center, not a person who can be educated and counseled, and through peer pressure of her sister or mother or daughter or husband, learn that this is not a good thing to do and be supported in that decision, but rather a person who absolutely cannot understand it because of her own impairment, who is going to bear a child that almost certainly will be impaired. Because if you had one fetal alcohol child and you continue drinking, you're almost guaranteed to have more. And that child will then be the responsibility of the state for life. In that extreme situation, the women that I talked to about this have suggested that if nothing else works, to incarcerate someone until they dry out, until they can be put into the care of someone who can ensure that they will take care of themselves, is probably a better solution than doing nothing. And it's not a solution that anybody has come to easily, and I should add that it is a solution that is proposed only in instances where a woman has decided to bring a child to term.
Are you concerned about precedents it would set if there was incarceration of pregnant women?
I'm absolutely concerned about that. It is a moral gray area in which you have two competing rights, the right of an adult person to do whatever she wants, whenever she wants, and the right of a child for a whole life. And the people that I talked to about this came to the conclusion, very reluctantly, that if it was a choice between not allowing one right to be exercised for a couple of months versus an entire lifetime of retardation, that this was a difficult but necessary choice to make.
And do you side with that now, or?
Yes, I do. I wish, and I'm sorry to say this, but I wish that Adam's mother had been restrained from drinking somehow, preferably through counseling and peer counseling and supportive spouses and families. But anything that would have enabled my son to understand who he is, and to the extent that any of us understand it, why we're here, and to gain satisfaction out of some of the things that most people consider beautiful and wonderful. Yes, I wish he had that right.
My guest is writer Michael Doris, and his new book, The Broken Cord, is about his son, Adam, who has fetal alcohol syndrome. Adam is one of six children that you have. He's one of three who you adopted before you married Louise Erdrich. Your three other children are children that you and Louise had together. When Adam was 18, you decided to have him move out. I think so he could be, you live on a farm, it's pretty isolated. And I think your reason was this way he could live closer to a job and he'd be able to work
and
support himself. Yeah,
it was 20 when he moved out. Yes, he got to the point, at 21, the educational system kicks out. He was in a very good vocational training school in Hartford, Vermont, where I think it was the best possible place for him, but he couldn't continue there after 21. And their goal for all of their developmentally disabled students is to find them a job where they can have some sort of independence and satisfaction. And to do that, it was necessary for Adam to live in a place where he could get to and from work at odd hours, because the job he actually holds right now is a dishwasher at a truck stop, and sometimes he works on weekends, and sometimes he has a night shift, and sometimes a morning shift, and it would be nothing but chauffeuring for Louise and me if he were at home, and not really what he needed anyway. So he lives in a very, very good group home with a man and woman who take care of a number of young children and young adults who have problems. And it's within a 10-minute walk of where he works.
Mm-hmm. I know that you write full-time now, but you are a trained anthropologist and have studied mostly different Native American populations. How grave a problem do you think fetal alcohol syndrome represents now to Native Americans?
I think it is an extraordinarily serious problem. There are some communities on certain reservations, and it's not everywhere by any means, but there are some communities on certain reservations where it's estimated that by the turn of the century, if things progress as they are now going, that 40 or 50% of all children born will be impaired to some degree by maternal drinking. And that is a population that is terribly dependent on itself for limited resources and on the rest of the world for understanding and protection, which is the last thing that Indian people want or should need. But, for instance, with my son, if he has $10 and somebody says, I'll give you a donut if you give it to me, he'll give it to them, and he won't ask for change. If he had $10,000, he'd do exactly the same thing. If you're an Indian reservation that wants to get lease land back and somebody offers a short-term, very small recompense for that, and you have a large proportion of the voting population who can't see the long-term consequence, you might make a wrong decision as a population. So I think it's a very dangerous thing. But it's also a very dangerous thing, I think, in the Soviet Union, in Japan, in other parts of the world where this problem is also on the rise.
Michael Darris, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.